This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A dozen witnesses have testified over 5 days of public hearings in the House impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Over the next hour, we're going to walk through what we've learned over the last week and a half.
But we're going to begin with the testimony of the two people who may be the final witnesses in this public phase of the inquiry, former top National Security Council official Fiona Hill and David Holmes, an official from the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, who spent about 6 hours before the committee telling all of them what they knew about President Trump's efforts to pressure the Ukrainian president to conduct politically motivated investigations.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis and NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman are here with us to put the testimony of those two witnesses into context. Good to have you both here.
Hey there.
Begin by just drawing a picture of these two witnesses for us, because they were both really interesting characters. Sue, you want to begin by telling us about David Holmes, who was based in Kiev.
David Holmes is a late entry into the narrative of the impeachment story. He's someone we didn't even know about until Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador over there, testified, showed up on Capitol Hill in his own testimony, and revealed the existence of this aide who worked for him in the embassy in Ukraine, who indeed had had firsthand information that was willing to come to the committee. He took part in a phone call that I'm sure we'll get into the details of, but he then came and testified behind closed doors today, or behind closed doors, and then testified in public today on all the details of that phone call.
And even though it seemed as though he had just one piece of the puzzle before today's testimony began, he ended up having a lot to say.
Well he's a real note taker, as you noticed.
Unlike Gordon Sondland.
His opening statement was very long. His title at the embassy is political counselor at the U.S. Embassy. It's a job that's meant to kind of keep track of Ukrainian politics. So he said, I'm not a political appointee, he wanted to point out. He's a career State Department official. And career State Department official, as we've learned throughout these hearings, take very copious notes.
Right. And the other witness, Fiona Hill, who described herself as an American by choice, bringing that Northern England accent to the proceedings, is somebody who, Michelle, in your coverage of Russia over the years that you've been our diplomatic correspondent, you've gotten to know her very well because she's a Russia expert who's immersed in this.
Yeah, she is. I mean, like myself, she started studying Russian in the 1980s and has been involved in Russia ever since then. Worked a long time at the Brookings Institution. At the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration, she spent 3 years in this job on it's the National Intelligence Officer for Russia. So it's the National Intelligence Council. So she was used as a government analyst on Russian affairs. So she really knows this stuff very well. And she joined the Trump administration because, as I understand it, she really felt that after Russia attacked the U.S. in elections in 2016, she wanted to serve this government to make sure that doesn't happen again, and also to repair relations with Russia.
Now, she left her post at the National Security Council in mid-July, kind of in the middle of when all these events in question were happening. Do we know why she left her post?
Well, she had always said that she was going to only do it for a few years, a couple of years, and she actually went for about 2.5 years. And she did testify, not in this open hearing, but in her deposition, that she wanted to get out during the political season. That was a message she talked about a lot today. She's not a politician. She's not into politics. She's a nonpartisan foreign policy expert, which seems to be harder and harder
in
this
era. Okay,
so
we've got the cast of characters. Let's get to what they said.
Okay, so let's go to David Holmes. As Sue, you mentioned, he's narrated this cell phone conversation, this now very famous cell phone conversation he overheard in a restaurant in Ukraine. It was between Gordon Sondland, the EU ambassador, and President Trump. Let's play a piece of tape for you. This is how David Holmes remembers the cell phone conversation.
I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
Sue, why was this particular piece of testimony so important to Democrats? Why did they race to bring in David Holmes at the last minute in this public phase of the inquiry?
Well, one of the lines of defense from the White House and from Republicans on Capitol Hill is much of the accusations around the president involve what they consider hearsay, people who inferred things, who presumed things, who weren't inside the president's head.
Who knew things secondhand or third hand.
It was what they
directly
presumed was the understanding. And Holmes testified that he heard the president himself. It put the president square in the middle of the action in the decision-making, inquiring about these investigations, and getting assurances that they would take place.
But to be fair, Holmes never overheard President Trump say, are they going to do the investigations in exchange for a meeting at the White House? Holmes just overheard the first part of the alleged quid pro quo that Democrats say happened, right? Are they going to do the investigations is the quote from
right.
President Trump.
And Gordon Sondland, who was not as copious a note-taker, did not remember the explicit details of that call. He also testified this week, but he said he did not dispute Mr. Holmes' account.
Sue, you mentioned Gordon Sondland, who in his testimony said, look, I wasn't doing an irregular line of diplomacy on Ukraine. Everybody who needed to know about it knew about it. And yet, Fiona Hill was doing a line of diplomacy that didn't match what Sondland was doing. So here's how she clarified how she saw the two running parallel to each other.
It struck me one yesterday when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said, these are the people who need to know, that he was absolutely right, because he was being involved in a domestic political errand, and we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged.
Michelle, it was interesting to see lawmakers appear to try to bait Fiona Hill into attacking Sondland, and instead her response was, oh, no, I get you. You were just doing something different. You were doing something domestic, politically motivated.
And I think that moment really captured what we're talking about here. I mean, U.S. policy to Ukraine was to help it push back against Russian aggression. But President Trump and his private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, wanted something else from Ukraine. They wanted these investigations that could help Trump politically. We know from Sondland that he said he was working on that at the direction of the president, he said yesterday. He said he had these contacts with the president, so he didn't need to keep Fiona Hill and others in
the
loop.
He was one of the few people who could get the president on the cell phone, seemingly whenever he wanted to.
Right, and she was annoyed by the fact that he was cutting her out. But in fact, after hearing all of his testimony, she was said, well, he was right, because they were being a political errand, running a political errand for the president, and people like Fiona Hill and a lot of others who we've heard from know that that was wrong.
Speaking of that political errand, going back to David Holmes, the other witness today, he was also privy to a direct conversation he had with Gordon Sondland himself when he was asking Gordon Sondland about what does President Trump think about Ukraine. Let's listen to David Holmes describe that conversation.
In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing.
Sue, how does that particular piece of David Holmes's testimony help buttress the overall Democrats' case that there was a quid pro quo?
Yeah, I mean, this goes to this idea of the irregular channel and the official channel. And this is something that I think Republicans brought up a lot in their defense, too. And this is part of the broader argument that the White House and others have made. The president did all these things, but they believe it was in the prerogative of the president, that he had a different view of what U.S.-Ukraine policy should be, or he did have concerns about corruption and he was acting on it. What the career folks, people like Fiona Hill and David Holmes testified to do today said, yeah, you know what? The president does get to set the foreign policy. But if he was setting foreign policy, he didn't tell anyone that's job it is to enact
that foreign policy. Experts, right.
Right? Like that's the conflict here. Sure, if he changed policy, we adapt. He didn't tell us that he was changing policy.
But also what the policy was, right? I mean, there's the policy that's in the U.S. national security interests, which is what we're talking about. Ukraine's at war with Russia. Russia attacked us in 2016 in the elections. You know, how do you push back against this very aggressive Russia these days? That's the official policy. That's even the Trump administration's official policy.
Right.
But this political line and in getting involved in politics is not something that the U.S. government should be doing, is what the argument is from people like Fiona Hill and others.
In a few minutes, we're going to pull the camera back and talk about the entire arc of these public impeachment hearings. But there was something Fiona Hill said in this last day that I think kind of set up a common thread, which was that you had so many diplomats, people who are ostensibly and often in practice nonpartisan, coming out and saying, I am not for or against impeachment. I'm just here to deliver the facts. I want to listen to part of what Fiona Hill said here. And then, Michelle, since you have reported on so many diplomats for so many years, I'd like your perspective on this.
Are you a never Trumper, or have you been true to your profession and remain nonpartisan?
I honestly don't know what the definition of a never Trumper is, as I think many of my colleagues are feeling the same way, that it's a puzzling term to be applied to career or nonpartisan officials. And I chose to come into the administration. I could easily have said no when I was approached.
Yes, but you didn't sign up to have hateful calls and the like.
That comment there from Representative Terry Sewell, Democrat from Mississippi. Michelle Kellerman, this was true of so many of the witnesses.
Yeah, I mean, unlike some of the others, though, you know, the others are career foreign policy officials who are going to be moved around to different jobs, and that's their job. As Fiona Hill said, she actually joined this administration. She saw her expertise as something that could be useful to this administration, and she was very clear that she wasn't there to be a partisan, and that was one of the that's why I thought this moment was so interesting when she talked about that these other people were working on this political errand and we were working on national security.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and that's where it
those
comes
two missions clash. Diverged.
Right.
She also made a point today to say, look, let me just dispel any sort of fiction that the Ukrainians were involved in interference in the 2016
election. She wasn't
election.
Having it.
She said that very adamantly in the closed-door deposition, and she said it again today in the open hearing.
Some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports.
That was Fiona.
It is beyond dispute.
That was Fiona Hill, one of the final witnesses in the public impeachment hearings. Coming up, we will walk through what we have learned through 5 days of testimony spread across 2 weeks. This is special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For only the fourth time in U.S. history, Congress is considering impeaching a president. This time, it is Donald Trump, and congressional investigators are trying to determine if the 45th president pressured Ukraine's leader to conduct investigations that could have helped Trump take out a political opponent.
Members of the House Intelligence Committee have been hearing public testimony since November 13th, and it seems that this phase of the process has come to an end.
All right, so we're going to spend some time going over what we have learned since the public testimony began last week. And to do that, we're joined now by NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hey, Sue.
Hey, Elsa.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hey, Michelle.
Hi there.
NPR justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. Hey, Ryan.
Hey there.
And NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hey.
Hey, Elsa.
All right, so I just want to start with the moments that are going to stay with each of you from the last 2 weeks of public testimony. Sue, I'm going to start with you first. What was your big moment?
So I think one of the moments, both in substance and in image, that will linger from this phase of the impeachment process is from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified partly because of the image. He testified in full military dress. He's a Purple Heart veteran. He's active duty military, essentially testifying against the commander in chief in terms of wow moment. And he spoke to sort of the heart of this question, the White House defense, the July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president. It was a perfect call. It was a perfect call. And Vindman said he didn't think so.
Let's take a listen to that.
On July 25th, 2019, the call occurred. I listened on the call in the Situation Room with White House colleagues. I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
I also think Vindman was fascinating, too, because he is someone that Republicans really took swipes at, that they seemed to question not just his loyalty to the country, he was not born here, but also whether he was politically motivated, essentially because he just didn't like the decisions the president was making and sort of spoke to the ugly partisanship of this process.
Ryan Lucas, what moment stood out to you from these last 5 days of hearings?
There have been quite a few moments, but whittling it down to one, I'm going to go with Gordon. Gordon Sondland.
He was the U.S. ambassador to the European Union.
The U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who had a lengthy opening statement yesterday. One of the main questions hanging over this has been, was there a quid pro quo? We certainly heard from the president for a long time, no quid pro quo. The president's allies said the same thing. And then Sondland, in his testimony, says, no, actually, you know what? There was a quid pro quo.
Let's listen to that.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election.
So, Ryan, there you have the ambassador unequivocally stating with regard to a White House call and a White House meeting, there was a quid pro quo. Republicans drilled into what about the hold on aid to Ukraine, military assistance?
That's right. And he was asked about that. And what he said was, I put two and two together. I inferred from the fact that there was no meeting and the aid was being held. If the meeting was being held because of the investigations, the aid was likely being held because of the investigations as well. He said that he presumed that. Did he have direct evidence of it? Did he ever hear it from the president himself? He said no.
By the way, this whole quid pro quo, you know, Democrats have been using the word bribery. They've been using the word term quid pro quo. Ryan, to the extent you know, is there any substantive difference between a quid pro quo and bribery?
All of this gets down to the basic question of abuse of office. Mm-hmm. That's what this really all boils down to, is whether the president was abusing his office, was leveraging official acts to get something out of the Ukrainians. That's what it basically comes down to. And bribery, as it can be understood, can mean that as well.
Essentially a quid pro quo. Okay, Michelle Kellerman, let's go to you. What was your standout moment in these last 2 weeks?
There were way too many. But let's just stick with this Sondland testimony for a bit, because he really kind of threw a lot of people under the bus there. And, you know, all along he's been talked about as this irregular channel to Ukraine.
Rogue foreign policy
guy. He said
guy.
He was in the center lane, that he got this from President Trump, wanted him to be talking to Rudy Giuliani, and Rudy Giuliani wanted this quid pro quo on investigations.
Let's take a listen to that.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th.
Michelle, when he says everyone, who does he mean?
Well, for one, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was his boss, he did show several exchanges that he had with the secretary, who, by the way, has not provided a lot of evidence. He hasn't cooperated with the investigation.
Right. It seems that he named so many people, none of whom are testifying. I mean, he named Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the president, the vice president, the White House
chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney.
None of them are going to testify.
Right. Since I cover the State Department, I always zero in on that. And Secretary Pompeo's spokesperson responded saying Sondland never told the secretary that he believed the president was linking aid to investigations of political opponents. Now, that's not what Sondland was testifying. What Sondland was testifying was that he did keep in touch with Pompeo about this push to get Ukrainians to announce investigations. Pompeo was in the loop on that. And of course, Pompeo was also on that phone call when President Trump asked the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for a favor, which included investigation into the Bidens.
Pompeo was actually in Brussels this week, where Gordon Sondland is typically based. And when a reporter asked whether he would recuse himself based on what Sondland testified to, this is what Pompeo said.
I didn't see the testimony. I'm not going to recuse myself from this. I know precisely what American policy was with respect to Ukraine. I was working on it, and I'm incredibly proud of what we've accomplished. We delivered remarkable outcomes for the Ukrainian people.
So basically, it sounds like at the end of Sondland's testimony, he's saying, how could I be in any rogue lane, in any irregular channel, if I was constantly keeping National Security Council, State Department, the White House, from the president to the vice president in the loop the entire time? Okay, Greg Myrie, what was your big standout moment throughout the last 2 weeks of the public phase of this whole impeachment inquiry?
I'm going to go with Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine, who brought up this rather quaint notion dating all the way back to the 1940s that foreign policy is not something that should become an issue to fight over. So we'll listen to her talk about how foreign policy used to be.
Senator Vandenberg, a Republican senator who actually partnered with President Truman, coined a phrase that politics should stop at the water's edge. And I think that's exactly right, because while obviously the competition of ideas in a democracy with different parties, different individuals is hugely important, but at the end of the day, when we are dealing with other countries, it needs to be about what is right for the United States.
Of course, Marie Yovanovitch is the witness who, when she was testifying, Trump was actively tweeting attacks at her. Remind us what Trump was tweeting during her testimony.
Well, he said everywhere she had gone in her long diplomatic career had gone bad, dating all the way back to Somalia, which collapsed in 1990. She was a young junior diplomat.
One of her first posts.
It was, in fact, I think her first post, yes. So he was making very personal attacks, and she was pointing out to this nonpartisan tradition that really held sway for generations that the politics ends at the water's edge.
There have not been many impeachment hearings of a president in U.S. history, but there has certainly never been one where the president was tweeting in real time about the witness, and the witness was being asked about it by the committee chairman, in this case, Adam Schiff.
As you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record. And now the president in real time is attacking you. What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
Designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously.
There were all of these moments during the hearing where it seemed that lawmakers were suggesting, oh, this person's not cooperating. Well, obstruction of Congress could well be an impeachment charge. Witness intimidation could well be an impeachment charge. Sue Davis, do you think that is actually likely to be on the list, assuming that House Democrats do draw up articles of impeachment?
Well, Adam Schiff has made clear that it's not just the substance of the investigation that could be considered articles of impeachment. It is how the White House has conducted itself in this investigation. And the defiance of subpoenas, the defiance of document and data requests from places like the State Department, Schiff has said over and over again that they would see those actions as obstructive acts. And furthermore, that the action of not handing it over would be considered evidence that it would prove the wrongdoing that they were suggesting.
I want to turn now to how we've been watching Republican defenses evolve over the course of the weeks of this entire impeachment inquiry. I want to throw this out to, well, any of you, but in particular, Sue and Ryan. What kind of defenses? Well, before we get that, actually, I want you to listen to a piece of tape. This is Elise Stefanik, a Republican from upstate New York, and she's sort of pounding down on the heart of the Republican argument here.
For the millions of Americans viewing today, the two most important facts are the following. Number one, Ukraine received the aid. Number two, there was in fact no investigation into Biden.
Essentially making the point, how could there be a quid pro quo if Ukraine got the military aid and there was no actual investigation into the Bidens, at least no newly opened investigation into the Bidens? Sue and Ryan, how have you seen Republican arguments over the course of these last few weeks evolve? Go ahead, Ryan.
First, I think it's important to add a little bit of context to what Stefanik said. Mm-hmm. Saying that Ukraine got the aid, yes, Ukraine did get the aid. They waited 55 days for that aid to be, for the hold on that aid to be lifted by the White House. There was never a reason supplied for that aid to be lifted. And the timing of when that aid was lifted was September 11th. 2 days before that, House Democrats announced an investigation into what they said was a Trump-Giuliani scheme to basically dig up dirt in Ukraine. Also, the whistleblower complaint at that point in time was something that the administration was aware of. There was building political pressure for that aid to be, for the hold on that aid to be released. That's an important point, and the context of that is worth mentioning. She is right in the sense that there were no investigations ultimately, but we do know that that the Ukrainian president had scheduled an interview with CNN as the president, as we know from testimony that the president wanted to hear, and canceled that. It was scheduled for September 13th, and they canceled it once they knew that the aid had come through.
I think Republicans are focused in their defense on the outcomes, not the actions the president took before them, right?
And the intent.
And the intent of them. But to the point that Ryan made, the outcomes were good for Ukraine. That's Pompeo's point, too. I focus on our outcomes. The outcomes for Ukraine are that we are still their ally. I think the sum total of these 2 weeks of testimony have sort of attacked every wall of the Republican defense in some way, shape, or form. You know, you have, it was a perfect call. You have people like Vindman. No quid pro quo. You had Sondman. Ukraine meddling is maybe something we should look at. Fiona Hill today was saying, no, absolutely not. Even Special Envoy Kurt Volker, who testified, was talking about the question of the Bidens. Maybe there's something there. And he testified, Joe Biden's a good man, and I'd never seen him do anything but honorable. So all the sort of lines of defense haven't been totally knocked down, but they were weakened at the end of this process.
There was one very good outcome that they got from Sondland's testimony, though, and also from, I would say, from Holmes's testimony, which is, while they both said that they had presumed that the military aid, the hold on the military aid, was linked to the investigations, but neither one of them could point to direct evidence that would indicate that that was exactly what the president had said. It was something that they presumed, the impression that they had, but there was no clear link.
The Democrats kept saying 2 + 2 = 4, and the Republicans kept saying, this is not hearsay testimony, this is, I'm guessing, testimony.
And remember, they haven't heard from Mick Mulvaney, who would have that answer to exactly why it was held up, though he did suggest at a news conference early on in this that, yeah, the president wanted to investigate.
Get used to it
these
was his phrase.
There was another Republican point that, well, how could there have been a quid pro quo if Ukraine didn't know that the military aid was withheld? But that argument came crashing down, too, because we got some testimony from Laura Cooper last night that maybe the Ukrainians did know the aid was being withheld. I see Sue and Ryan doing like, maybe, sort of.
Yeah, okay. Laura Cooper's a Pentagon official. Uh-huh. She's in charge of Ukraine military aid. She's sort of the policy wonk inside the Pentagon. She did testify that as early as July 25th, the day of the call, there was contact between Ukraine and the Pentagon inquiring about the status of the aid, whether they were aware that the Trump administration had put a hold on the aid. She did not testify that she knew that, but she did make that point that earlier than that September date, Ukrainians were sort of asking where their money was because it had been approved and announced by the Pentagon back in June.
And Greg, do you want to weigh in on the argument that Republicans made that Ukraine is a corrupt country, as the United States has acknowledged, and President Trump has every interest, and the United States has every interest in fighting corruption?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of irony there. I mean, the man who ran his campaign was steeped in corruption coming out
Paul
Manafort. So,
who had advised the deposed Ukrainian leader who was pro-Russia.
You could argue, and again, I think that is probably the source of President Trump's anger or negative view of the Ukraine, that his own campaign manager came down, and from the very early days of his presidency, he's had this attitude towards Ukraine.
I think Republicans would say, well, look, Democrats had every advantage. They're in the majority. They got to draw up the witness list. With the exception of two witnesses who were Republican witnesses, how did they do? Did they help the GOP cause?
I don't necessarily know if they were Republican witnesses as much as they were people that there were three of the witnesses called in that Republicans also said they wanted to hear from.
Well, let's identify them. There was former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker. He was requested by the Republicans. And there's former National Security Council official Tim Morrison. Okay, what were they supposed to do for the Republicans?
I think that they offered the least damning of testimony and also made points that are, you know, if Vindman's point that he thought the call was improper is valid to this investigation. Tim Morrison also testifying under oath that he didn't find it improper is also valid to this investigation. I think it helped Republicans to the extent that they were trying to prove and are still trying to prove that different people had different interpretations of the same events and that you can't vote to remove a president from office because some people, and this is their argument, that some people didn't think it was appropriate.
Let's listen to part of Tim Morrison's testimony that I think nobody would disagree with.
As I stated during my deposition, I feared at the time of the call on July 25th how its disclosure would play in Washington's political climate. My fears have been realized.
My fears have been realized. Would anyone like to weigh in on how this has all played in Washington's political climate before we take a short break?
Morrison falls into this camp, and I'm sure Michelle can talk to this too, is that he's not seen as someone who came from inside the career system, right? He's not technically a political appointee, but these are people that have come from more partisan Republican politics and not the official channels.
He came from the Hill, actually. And what he was referring to was why they put the call record after it was over into a separate server, a more secret one, to limit the access to this document, because he knew that there were some controversial things on there that the president was asking the new Ukrainian government to look into debunked conspiracy theories about the 2016 election and into the Bidens.
Another thing that Tim Morrison said, and maybe Ryan, you can chime in as well, is that he didn't think that the call, that anything on the call was illegal.
He didn't think that there was anything illegal on the call. Now, what Democrats would say is it's not really up to him to make that decision. The decision on whether it rises to the level of impeachable or not lies with the lawmakers who he was testifying
for. It's a more
for.
Political question
exactly.
rather than a legal question. But you were raising your hand to say something else.
I was going to say that I think that regardless of the current political climate, if a transcript of a call like this had come out in previous administrations as well, it would have caused an uproar as well. That is not limited to just our current political climate.
All right, we're going to take a look at some of the people who still have not testified during this impeachment inquiry. And then we're going to talk about where this whole inquiry goes from here in the next months. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We have reached the end of this phase, at least. We have heard what we believe may be the final public testimony before the House Intelligence Committee. That committee is conducting the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump.
We've spent much of the last hour talking about the people who have testified, what they have said, and how that has shaped our understanding of what may have happened. We're now going to spend our final minutes discussing the people who have not testified. We're talking about White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and the president's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani, just to name a few.
Here in the studio with us to do that are NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis, diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, justice correspondent Ryan Lucas, and national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, all right.
Set the table for us. Before we dive into all these people we haven't heard from, just a couple weeks ago, we were looking at thousands of pages of closed-door testimony, transcripts. What do we know today that we did not know from those documents?
Well, the one big thing was on the very first opening, when we had Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador in Ukraine, he said that one of his aides had overheard this phone call between Sondland and the president a day after the July phone call between Trump and his Ukrainian.
Right, the now famous cell phone call that now seems even more famous or just as famous as the July 25th
right,
phone
call. Right, and that set off a very fast-paced, not only getting this guy, David Holmes, to Washington to testify behind closed doors right after that. Then they had to have him in public today at the end of this process.
I think Sondland really tried to, or may have effectively changed the way people were looking at the channels. I think even in the reporting in the closed door era, and then into the public, everyone, including members on the committee, were referring to an irregular channel or this offshoot channel. And he really clearly testified that this was a channel that had a direct line to the president over and over and over again.
Memory was also refreshed a bit.
That is true.
Did revise his testimony.
Maybe not the most reliable witness in this narrative, but him saying that this came from the president, and I was following orders, is very important testimony to the heart of the question of impeachment.
And I also thought, unless you really poured through thousands of pages of documents, what this testimony brought out is how early people were flagging this, that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman went twice to the lawyers at the NSC, that Laura Cooper, the Pentagon official, says the Ukrainians were inquiring about the aid back on July 25th. So, you know, this didn't all break until about 2 months ago in September, but all of this stuff that was happening back in July, it was being red flagged from several different places.
And the ouster of the ambassador.
Marie Yovanovitch.
Which was earlier. I mean, I was following that and tracking that and trying to get answers from the State Department at the time in the spring. They were really not saying very much at the time, but now we know so much more.
Sue, your point about the so-called irregular channel actually being a very mainstream channel is a good pivot to all the people who we haven't heard from, because the folks who were aware of Sondland's activities included all of these extremely powerful people in the Trump administration, from cabinet officials to senior White House aides, none of whom have agreed to testify, even though many of them have been subpoenaed. Explain how they can just defy those subpoenas and why we're not going to hear from them.
Well, the White House from the start, once Nancy Pelosi back in September said we're now on an impeachment inquiry, from the get-go, the White House said this is a sham, this is a bad process, we're not going to participate. So they've kind of drawn a line. A good thing to remember is all these people that came out and testified did so under subpoena and against the direction of the White House and the State Department and their official channels. So the White House has tried to block all kinds of people from participating. The only ones that are really going to directly listen to the president are the ones that sit closest to him. And in those cases, these are the folks you've named.
The ones who still work for him. For example, National Security Advisor John Bolton no longer works for President Trump. He has still not agreed to testify.
Bolton's a little bit different.
Tell
us
why.
Bolton has said that he would testify, or has indicated he would testify, but he's not going to do so in defiance of the White House. He thinks there is a legitimate legal question over whether people that close to the president can have to listen to Congress or have to listen to the White House.
Elsa,
but if there was a judge that told him to do it, he'd indicate.
Interesting.
Elsa, a conversation earlier today with a former aide to Bolton who pretty explicitly said, I think Bolton wants a future in the Republican Party, and you don't get that by defying the president.
Exactly. And Bolton is known, as we know from NPR Mara Liasson's reporting, that Bolton is someone who's a stickler for process, a stickler for protocol. So do you think that in part has motivated him not to testify?
Sure. Although I think Bolton not testifying is a big gaping hole here. He is clearly someone who was in the room at so many points of this storyline, who clearly had strongly held feelings about things like the engagement of Rudy Giuliani, and his testimony could probably provide a lot of clarity.
Ryan Lucas?
There is one important note about Bolton and one thing that he believes in. He also believes very strongly in executive power. And one of the reasons that the administration is saying that senior officials, those in the closest circle to the president, don't have to testify, don't have to be compelled to testify by a subpoena, is because they are absolutely immune from being compelled to testify before Congress. And that is something that the court case that his deputy, who was subpoenaed as part of this process, is challenging in court.
Are you talking about Kupperman?
Exactly.
Okay.
There were a few. I mean, even though he hasn't testified, we do know some things about John Bolton. For instance, he described the Sondland's dealings with this offering White House meeting in exchange for investigations as a drug deal, and he told Fiona Hill to report that to the White House lawyers. He also described Rudy Giuliani as a hand grenade. So he does have colorful language.
Does have colorful language.
He had Fiona Hill go to the lawyers, and he also encouraged Bill Taylor, the chargé, the acting ambassador in Ukraine, to write a cable to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, telling him that it was folly to hold up this military aid to Ukraine.
And Bolton's lawyer has actually almost kind of taunted Congress in a way by saying,
yes,
you know,
go ahead and subpoena him.
He's got a lot of things that you haven't heard yet, and he would
he's
love
also got
to
a book
testify.
Deal.
He also has a book deal.
Let's pivot from former White House aide John Bolton to current White House acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney, who, while he has not agreed to testify, did come into the White House briefing room in October and make some very candid comments, including that there was a quid pro quo.
And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
When we heard that in October, everybody was pretty shocked. Now that we've heard all this testimony, does it sort of put it in a different light, a different context?
Well, I think the thing that makes Mulvaney so interesting and why we haven't heard from him is if there is one individual who could testify to that question of why the military aid was withheld, it is Mick Mulvaney. As every other person in this testified, every interagency in that process wanted the aid to go. The only agency that raised its hand and said don't was OMB, the Office of Management and Budget.
Which he used to head.
That is the office he used to head. He might still be the acting head. Or I think he's like, got a lot of acting jobs.
Acting chief staff, yeah.
And that people testified that the call came down from Mulvaney.
Do we have any reporting on what Mulvaney was thinking at that time when he said the things we just heard on that piece of tape? Was he going against the White House?
Well, he certainly backtracked afterwards.
He tried to walk those comments back and say that they had been misconstrued. He didn't actually say that there was a quid pro quo, although he said what he said, and it's on tape.
I want to ask about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He's someone who has figured into these impeachment hearings. Michelle Kellerman, what is your sense of how, as his role has been described in more and more detail throughout these last few weeks, you know, how has that maybe reshaped Pompeo's status within the administration? Because up until now, he's been kind of this ally of Trump that's been so far a survivor who hasn't, at least in the open, seeming to get into a lot of conflicts with the president. How do you think he's fared after these last few weeks?
Well, he was traveling this week. He does defend the president. He hasn't strayed from that at all. He has not spoken up publicly in favor of all of these people who have testified, and he's been given several chances to do that. And that's been very noticeable in the building and among Foreign Service officers. He also did not, you know, stand up for Marie Yovanovitch or speak out publicly when she was smeared by this false information and ousted. All we know from this testimony is that he reached out to Sean Hannity because some of these claims against Marie Yovanovitch were being spread by him, and saying, if you have information, that's one thing, but if you don't, if this is false, back off.
But I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel like his star has fallen or his capital has reduced in any way because his role has been more and more defined as we've been learning more and more during these impeachment inquiry hearings?
Oh, I think already he'd been spending a lot of time going to Kansas. There's an open Senate seat there, and there's a lot of speculation that that he'll eventually do that.
And you're certainly not going to win a Senate primary by criticizing Donald Trump in Kansas.
So another key witness who we were hearing a lot from until he suddenly went silent is Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, who appeared to be the funnel through which this entire quote-unquote irregular Ukraine channel went. Ryan, I know you have spoken with Giuliani. You have been researching what he's been up to. If we were to hear from him, what would the questions be that the lawmakers would want to ask him?
I think that the most immediate question would be, were you acting explicitly on the direct orders of the president of the United States? Now, Giuliani is the president's personal attorney. He would probably say that that is
protected by attorney-client privilege.
Attorney-client, exactly. Or they would exert executive privilege over those communications. The issue is with me that Giuliani clearly for many months has been driving these theories, these allegations against Joe Biden, pushing these investigations. He worked with two Soviet-born businessmen, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who were indicted last month in the Southern District of New York on campaign finance charges. They have both pleaded not guilty. But those are two men who were working with Giuliani to dig up this dirt in Ukraine. Giuliani, after being quite happy to talk to the press for a long stretch of time, he was on TV pretty much every night.
Tweeting all the time.
He was very easy to get on the phone. I was texting with him. He has essentially gone silent since.
And lawyered up.
And lawyered up, exactly. He's hired three lawyers, actually. After a long time, actually saying a week or two before he did hire lawyers, he was saying, I don't need anybody. I'm not in any sort of legal trouble. The clouds appear to be circling.
Well, as we're talking about these fantasy witnesses for Democrats, is there any chance that they could be subpoenaed and therefore be forced to testify? Or if they are subpoenaed, we would expect a protracted, very, very long court battle that would last far too long to be practical for the length of this impeachment process?
No, because Democrats aren't subpoenaing anybody. I mean, that's...
And what's the strategy behind that?
I mean,
not subpoenaing this particular set of people?
Because I think that as Democrats have indicated, they're not... I think in the words, I think Adam Schiff has always called it rope-a-dope, that they see defying subpoenas as just a stalling tactic. And I don't think that they necessarily believe that they need this testimony. I think if you listen to Adam Schiff's closing argument today, I think Democrats think that they have everything they need to know.
So if we take that as the end of the public phase of the impeachment hearings, what happens next?
So I want to caution, we don't know for certain that intel's done. They haven't announced that. What Schiff said is they would make a decision in the coming days.
And Republicans have asked for another day of hearings with the witnesses that they want to call.
So it's possible there could be more testimony, but there's nothing scheduled. There's nothing planned. There's no more depositions.
What witnesses do Republicans still want to call? Do we know?
There are DNC aides. There's the Biden.
There's the whistleblower.
The whistleblower. Yes. The missing Biden. Accuser. Okay.
But if we all, there was an assumption today that we were at least at the end, if not approaching the end, if not at the end of it. The next question is the Intel Committee is charged with writing a report on their findings, and then they have to send that report over to the Judiciary Committee, which has the actual jurisdiction to have impeachment hearings that could result in articles of impeachment that could be used to remove the president from
office. So more hearings. So what kind of witnesses would appear in those kinds of hearings at the Judiciary Committee phase?
So this is really unclear because this is part of the weird process that Democrats have utilized in this, that normally impeachment proceedings happen in the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee would have called all these witnesses and done all of this investigation. Because it was under the purview of Intel, we don't really know if Judiciary is going to want to hear from additional people. The fascinating thing that happens in the next phase, though, is the White House has a call to make. The Judiciary's Committee is where the White House counsel can be present. They can question witnesses.
Oh.
They can provide their own evidence. They have much more rules of engagement before Judiciary.
They'll have a lot more leverage in the process.
And a lot more strategy to play out. And the White House has a very interesting decision to make, and they have not indicated what they're going to do or who their counsels will be yet.
But just to kind of give this whole thing a reality check, Nancy Pelosi has said that she wants to complete the impeachment phase by the end of the year. If the House Judiciary Committee takes us over, there's just not enough time to have a protracted series of hearings at that stage, right, to finish by the end of 2019.
No, and giving it to Intel gave Adam Schiff the prerogative to do these investigations. If they're moving forward, Judiciary, the presumption is they could move within a week or two, have a couple hearings on the report, move forward with the articles.
In our last few minutes, let's talk about what has changed since this began, because everything from the role of career diplomats to the actual geopolitical situation in Ukraine with Russia has been shaped by what we've heard in the last 2 weeks and what's happened behind closed doors before that. Should we start with the geopolitical impact of this, Greg Myrie?
Yeah, sure. There is still a war going on in eastern Ukraine. It's a low-intensity war, but the Russians and the separatists are still there fighting the Ukraine army. And President Zelensky is planning to meet President Putin of Russia in Paris, tentatively set for December the 9th. They're trying to work out a peace agreement, or actually implement an agreement that was worked out 4 years ago. So we've still got a conflict that remains unresolved. President Zelensky is going to go into that with a lot less backing from the U.S.
Right, I'm sure he would much have preferred having that White House meeting before this meeting with Putin.
All of this testimony has shown how shaky his support is. And so, yes, I think he wanted to go in there with a clear support of the president of the United States.
And the U.S. Envoy, actually, Kurt Volker, he was a part-time envoy, unpaid. And his job was to work on this peace process between the Germans and the French and the Ukrainians and the Russians. And so there was a hope that the U.S. would play a stronger role in this diplomacy, but he's now left under this after this impeachment inquiry started.
So is it overstating things to say that this impeachment inquiry and all the facts that have come to surface because of it have recalibrated the geopolitical relationships between Ukraine and Russia and the U.S., or am I overstating?
Well, the Ukrainians certainly hope not, and you did see a strong bipartisan support for the aid that the Trump administration did eventually give. You heard from all of the people who are working in this file that this is a crucial time for Ukraine.
And then, Michelle, tell us about what the impact of this testimony and these hearings has been on career diplomats. On the one hand, you had Fiona Hill testifying that she has been attacked and had her personal information disclosed publicly online. On the other hand, some analysts have described this as, quote unquote, revenge of the deep state.
Yeah, well, They certainly don't like to be called deep state. I mean, that, and, you know, that was the one thing. It was a very uncomfortable position for all these people to be in. I mean, they were subpoenaed, as we said, their career government public servants. They're not going to defy a subpoena from Congress. And they were there to tell the facts as they see it. It did spark, at least among the Foreign Service officers and current and past, a big Twitter hashtag and Facebook, FS Proud, Foreign Service Proud, all over telling their stories and about their own public service. And the American public got to see what diplomats do, which I guess, as long as they're not seen as too partisan here, is could be a good thing.
There was a nice moment with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who is not a Foreign Service officer, but he's a Ukraine expert at the National Security Council. He was wearing his military uniform. He's a decorated veteran. And he was talking about having been born in Ukraine, his pride at now being an American in spite of the attacks.
This is America. This is the country I've served and defended, that all of my brothers have served, and here, right matters.
Thank you, sir. Yield back.
We have been focusing for all these days on the House phase of this impeachment process. But just in the few seconds we have left, I'll go to you, Sue Davis. The Senate will very likely be trying this whole impeachment. So can you just give us a sense of how that process will unfold?
Well, I know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell this week said he had not seen or heard anything that got him anywhere close to thinking that there was the votes to remove Trump from office. That would be 67 votes. So where do we stand that the end game of all this? The end game hasn't changed. The votes don't exist in the United States Senate to convict Donald Trump. And the most likely conclusion is that he will be acquitted by the Senate and he will have to run for re-election as an impeached president.
Well, I want to thank everyone who has been in the room following this, NPR Sue Davis, Ryan Lucas, Michelle Kellerman, and Greg Myrie. Thank you guys all so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This has been special coverage from NPR News. Thank you so much for listening.